Bears Robert Crane, a Microsoft Office 365 MVP who knows practically everything there is about Office 365. He does stand-up events talking about Office 365. He writes about Office 365 on his blog site, and he does in-person training sessions and training videos about Office 365. There's also me, Mark Keane. I'm the voiceover guy and producer of this podcast. I'm also a Microsoft Azure technical specialist, PowerShell extraordinaire, and IT consultant helping people move to the Microsoft cloud and consume it by helping them to make sense of it. This is the Need to Know podcast with Robert Crane and Mark Keane.
Contact us by email.
Feedback@needtoknow.cloud. It's your destination for anything Microsoft Cloud, including Azure and Office 365.
Well, along to another Need to Know podcast from Computer Information Agency. My name is Robert Crane, and across the other end of the microphone, all the way down the interweb, is Mark Keane. Mark, welcome.
I'm a long way away through masses of miles of cable. Hello.
Exactly. Or you have to go around the long way through the internet to get to you, obviously. So, but you're there. That's the main thing.
And get squashed through it.
Well, it's amazing what we can do with the internet today. We can do all these wonderful things and bring people the news of the day when it comes to cloud. And I'll kick it off today with what I thought was a very interesting announcement from Microsoft, that they are previewing conditional access for Office 365, Exchange, and SharePoint Online. So what this means is that one of the great things about Office 365 is that users can access anywhere, but some administrators obviously may not want their staff to be able to access it from public kiosk or perhaps even from home. So now, thanks to the power of Azure, you're able to set up restriction policies around that to prevent users logging in, obviously, on different IP addresses and, I believe, on different times. So we'll put the link in the show notes so people can have a play with that, and we should see that rolling out to all the tenants. That's been a big request. So a handy little feature that's been added to Office 365 thanks to the power of Azure.
So is that part of RMS, the conditional access?
No, basically what it is, it's the application. So basically when you go into the Azure Active Directory part of your Office 365, you obviously have a list of applications. So you've got users, groups, and then applications. If you look at applications, by default you'll have Office 365, say Exchange Online. You click into that, and when you do, at the moment, all you're given is a dashboard which just shows you the usage, how many users are using that individual app. But there will be a new item that you can select called Configure that will allow you to control access to that application in the background. So that's pretty powerful.
So it knows what devices that the person's connecting on.
Yeah, well, obviously you've got to log into the service, so that's how it's going to control it. And I think, again, looking at the blog post, wasn't too specific. I want to get to the specifics, but again, I think you basically control it by IP address. I believe there's also a time range. So, again, it will give administrators that ability to restrict users if they need to control access, through the corporate side of it, to obviously give better control, which is, again, a very requested feature.
So ABS mean anything to you in relation to this? Controlling access from certain parts of the world?
No, not really. I mean, I could take a guess, but why don't you enlighten us?
Australian Bureau of Statistics with the census thing that happened would have been good for them to control access so only people in Australia could get through. So the whole when they got the denial of service attack, which happened, they reckon, from overseas somewhere. Well, that's the thing. I mean, like, you know how like they had to shut down the servers after the third or fourth time due to precautionary measures, is what they were saying. They reckon it's because they got hacked from somewhere overseas. So, I mean, the other thing that people were saying was it would have been nice for them to block access to begin with from overseas, because, I mean, at the end of the day, it was only important for people to report for the population in Australia on that date.
Well, who knows what the real story is? I think that's the thing we've got to all figure out. We may never know. I mean, one side of it says, oh, you know, it was bad guys. The other side says, well, it was inadequate hardware, because apparently the ABS had outsourced that thing for the very first time. So, again, there's a lot of stories, innuendo floating around. I don't think we'll ever know for sure, but what we know is it didn't work. So hopefully it will work next time, or it is working now.
On the subject of working, something that is working beautifully is PowerShell, and it's been working beautifully for a long time. Obviously, PowerShell came out with Jeffrey Schnover, the date probably, I don't know, if, at least 5 years ago, isn't it? PowerShell's that
it's pretty old. I mean, it's been around for quite a while. I can't tell you when PowerShell version 1 was around, but yeah, I think it's you know, may even be server 2008, perhaps, can't remember exactly.
I think so, yeah, it's been around for a while. The big news is PowerShell is now open source. It's across Linux and Mac, and Mac obviously runs on Linux in the back end. And so, yeah, this is the huge news. Now, it all comes back to the other news that happened on June 27, when Microsoft announced they open source .NET. Now, .NET is what PowerShell runs on top of. So, .NET version 1, .NET Core, is now open sourced on Linux and across Macs as well. And so, because of that, PowerShell, it can easily be open sourced and run on top of those that platform, the .NET platform. So, it's fantastic news, I reckon, because it's going to expand that functionality out to more people and also to more a bigger community. So, just in case, a bit of a refresher: PowerShell is a task-based command line shell. Scripting language. It's built on the .NET framework, as I was saying before. It's to help IT professionals, not developers, IT professionals like us, or DevOps people, to help us control and automate the administration of Windows. And the other good thing about PowerShell, which I love, it glues everything together. It can talk to most other languages. It can glue stuff like WMI, regular expressions. It can kick off command line scripts that you can do with like command prompt. It can do a whole bunch of things together in the one pane of glass, and you can automate it. It runs with Azure automation and the whole thing. So yeah, so open sourced across Linux and Mac. Big news last week, Jeffrey Schnover with his blog post. He came out and he basically talked about the whole thing. So so we'll put the details in the show notes and the links. So yeah, there we go. What do you reckon, Rob? Big news?
It's a big step. It's obviously another step forward. I mean, they obviously moved with PowerShell 5 to the GitHub style repositories. Yes. and pulling that down. So that's another step towards that. So I think, again, Microsoft recognizes that to make it sort of a standard does have to move towards an open source. It certainly is embracing open source more around Linux. A lot of Azure machines, I think 40% now, actually run Linux. So,
correct.
Again, I think that it's good to see Microsoft embracing those and the tools and making that some of its core technology available for people to have a play with and, you know, start using on other platforms.
So 40%. So the other statistic here is as well the fact that nearly one in three VMs on Azure are running Linux, and also to nearly 60% of third party IaaS offers in the Azure marketplace are open source software. Did you know that? That's astounding. That's huge.
Yeah, and I think that's the way we're seeing. We're seeing a mixture of obviously proprietary software, but the trend certainly is into the open source world to move and give that speed of access and also that customization. So things along the lines of, like I said, the PowerShell, some of the tools, Chef, Puppet, those sort of things. Again, they're able to take advantage of that sort of thing as well. So I think if you're a dev, certainly something to pay attention to, and it's good to see Microsoft again moving away from basically a combative role when it comes to open source to a much more cooperative role and, again, contributing something back into the ecosystem.
So, yeah, we'll definitely, on the subject of Linux and open source, very, very shortly on this episode, we'll be talking to Trevor Sutherland about containers, and when we get into that very, very soon, we'll go through the history of it and how it started with Linux. Rob, have you got any other news?
Yeah, one other thing here that was the most requested feature for Azure Backup. Azure Backup now has the alerting and monitoring in preview, so we'll put the blog post in the show notes. But basically what that allows you to do is to set up email alerts on your backup jobs thanks to Azure Backup. It has to be obviously running in Resource Manager in the newer version, but you basically go in, set up the job. Then what you'll need to do is run a couple of PowerShell command line options just to enroll yourself in that service. And then when you run a job, you can then select what sort of email alerts you want. Nice, straightforward, and something that's been a major request, obviously, for people who are running Azure Backup to get some sort of feedback as to when the job obviously is successful or when it fails. So again, very interesting, and Microsoft makes a big point of indicating that it's taken those requests from User Voice. So User Voice is basically a way that users can go in and vote up and suggest options for improvement of all products, not only Azure, but things like OneDrive, Office 365, and then Microsoft typically is now using that to look at which features to bring to the fore first. So I think that's a great option, and certainly it'll answer a lot of questions that people have had around Azure Backup to give them more control.
See, I want to add too, the alerting capability of the Azure Backups is part of the OMS part of Azure.
Yeah, well, again, I think that this is where it gets a bit confusing. We do have things to change very quickly. And again, the Microsoft is sort of rebadging, rebranding some of this stuff. But at its core, it's still the same old familiar Azure Backup into basically a recovery vault. And now they've just added the ability to configure email alerts. So the name may have changed, and it probably will continue to change. But at its core, the functionality now is that you have email alerts available on your backup jobs to give you an indication of what's going on without having to go into the Azure console every time and check.
Fantastic. Anything else?
Nothing really at this stage. Again, we'll want to keep this nice and short so we can jump straight into our interview for this episode, which I think is probably the best idea, I would suggest now, Mark.
And a big guest we have too, Trevor Sullivan, MVP for Microsoft, and we're going to be talking about containers.
And Docker as well. Don't leave out the Docker part. That's just as important.
Yes, but as you'll hear very shortly, containers and Docker, nothing to be confused about.
Exactly.
Windows containers versus the Docker containers. Yes,
versus the virtual machine container versus, oh dear, now we've got confused.
It's typical Microsoft marketing.
We really should get on with the interview, I think, to straighten it out for people.
All right, here we go. Hey, Trevor.
Hello. How are you doing?
Not bad. Thanks for joining us. So
absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's fine. That's any time. So I guess we'll kick off with a brief introduction. I guess a lot of people in the industry would know who you are, including me, myself, and Rob would know who you are as well. But if you want to just give people a quick introduction of who you are and what you do.
Yeah, sure. So I'm working as a consultant right now. I have my own brand called Art of Shell, which refers to kind of just the essence of writing good quality shell code, typically PowerShell for me. But so yeah, I've been in the IT industry for about 12 years now, a little over, and I primarily work in the cloud and automation space. And over the past year or so, I've been breaking into the containerization space quite a bit.
Oh, okay. Good business to be in, Art of Shell, especially with the news that came out just recently, the open sourcing of Shell.
Yeah, PowerShell Core, it's known as. There's now two editions of it, PowerShell Desktop and PowerShell Core.
So the reason why I've got you on is, I guess, not to talk about PowerShell because it's been around for a long time, and I'm guessing most people would know what it is, and people that don't won't even go there. But you came on to talk about containers and Docker. Now, to set the scene, Rob, you're there in the background. You and I have had nothing pretty much to do with containers and Docker, so we're all raw to it. So I guess it's good. We're just like our average listener out there. If you want to start off by setting the scene of where we are today, and then just tell us why should we care about Docker and containers?
Docker solves some very interesting problems, and essentially what it is it allows you to componentize your applications into kind of a microservice architecture where you have more of a distributed application, and you don't really have these large monolithic applications that just grow and grow and grow and grow and never really get any smaller and really limit developer and IT operation agility, right? So what Docker containers really kind of enable is this new idea behind microservice architecture where when you need to scale up an application, you're not spinning up new virtual machines and having to go through a very rigorous, you know, deployment process to get some enterprise application up and running on a new virtual machine instance to increase the capacity of the application. So rather than spinning up entirely new virtual machines, what we can do is kind of spin up these lighter weight application containers, which I'm sure you've heard the term container many times by now. And it basically allows us to package an application along with its dependencies into a kind of a lighter weight container than what you would see with a virtual machine. So you're able to spin up new container instances much more rapidly than, you know, entirely new virtual machines and that entire app deployment process.
So isn't one of the issues with the microservices the fact that obviously if they're running in different containers or different machines, there's obviously an overhead to pay to make a call out to that service, whereas if it was all maybe running in the same memory stack, you would obviously get additional speed and that sort of thing. So that's one of the criticisms I've heard around microservices architecture, that obviously it makes the communication between the components slower than if it was, for example, all running in one, one RAM stack.
I mean, that's certainly a valid concern. I think it really does boil down to your application architecture really analyzing which components can be decoupled. I mean, there's not really a one-size-fits-all solution with microservices. And, as you point out, microservices may not be the solution for all application developers out in the industry. So, while microservices does present kind of a compelling architecture for some software developers, it's perfectly fine to continue down a monolithic route if that makes more sense based on an objective analysis.
So in your experience, what would be an application or that would lend itself well to containerization and Docker and that sort of thing? What sort of applications do you believe can really take advantage of this new architecture you're talking about?
Good question.
That is a good question. I will do my best to answer it, although I feel somewhat inadequate. To be honest, I think nearly any application could benefit from this kind of architecture. And any application that really needs to scale dramatically over a period of time. You know, one of the great things about the proliferation of the cloud industry is that we, you know, have this ability to basically pay as you go, or, you know, pay for what you use. And as customers kind of transition from hosting their own hardware, hosting their own data centers, to leveraging public cloud platforms like AWS and Microsoft Azure and the Google Cloud Platform, they certainly have the ability to kind of scale down their apps during low periods of demand. And I think that's really where kind of these microservice architectures that are enabled through Docker containers are going to thrive. If you're talking about social media platforms, I think those are certainly massively dynamic in terms of scale. There's going to be periods of heavy use, periods of lighter use, and that could really be said for nearly any enterprise application out there. I think maybe workloads that are less dependent on the ability to scale and to be agile in terms of capacity, that have more predictable amounts of throughput, or as you pointed out earlier, need particularly high amounts of throughput, I think those are probably more going to lend themselves well to a monolith architecture.
Yeah, I've got a question. I have a question because I'm still a little bit confused in relation to the container and the microservices. Now, because they're saying that containers are coming out with Windows Server 2016, I'm remembering back in the 2008 days when they said, oh, virtualization is going to come out with 2008, I think it was, or 2003, whichever version it was. So I'm relating containers back to virtualization down that layer. And then also down there's another layer called the physical layer. So there's hypervisor, virtual container. So is containers, am I right in saying it's like a mini virtual machine, or is it not even Windows? You can't log into it and stuff like that, or how does that work?
Well, so the best examples of containers that we can look at this point are the Linux Docker containers that were built on top of the C groups and namespace features that are built into the Linux, I think, 4.something kernel. Mm-hmm. And traditionally containers have been, but before Microsoft kind of decided to enter that space with Windows Server 2016, yep. is that they were basically isolated processes that would run on Linux. And so what's actually kind of interesting is that when you start a new container, it has what's called an entry point. And so typically your entry point will be will launch and initialize your application code, whether it's a web server or a database server. Could be a relational database server or a NoSQL instance.
Okay.
And so what's interesting is that you can actually the process that's running inside that entry point is actually completely isolated from the other processes on the system. So from that process's perspective, it is literally the only process that's running on the system. So with this new PowerShell core running natively on Linux Docker containers, what you can actually do is launch an interactive prompt inside a Docker container. And if you do a get process on that, the only thing you're going to see is the PowerShell process, and the process ID is just going to be one.
Rob, your turn.
So if I'm, you know, the average person working in IT, who's typically an IT pro rather than a developer, what sort of impact is this, you know, containerization and Docker going to have on me, in your opinion? Is it something that I need to have a look at? Do I need to start diving into it? Do I need to look at it as on the peripheral? Is it something that's just going to come along and I have to configure? I mean, what's the impact? Obviously, I understand it from a developer's point of view and the benefits there, but again, what about the average person, IT person, that's going to have to deploy this somewhere for the developer once the code is written? Is it something that I have to worry about there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a huge aspect of configuring Docker. Typically, developers are most likely going to be working in somewhat of an isolated environment where a developer is able to spin up a Docker host on their either Windows or Linux or Mac machine, and they can develop and test against that Docker host. But when you look at kind of the production application deployments, what's going to happen is you're going to start running into security concerns. So access control concerns, and you're also going to be looking at scaling concerns. Now, the interesting thing about the containerization and the Docker ecosystem is that there's a lot of different tools that kind of solve the same problems, and it's kind of an a la carte way of choosing what tools you want to do which task, right? So when you look at deploying an application at scale using containers, things you have to worry about are access control for sure. Providing the appropriate administrators access to, managing containers, to spinning up new containers, adding, virtual machines to a cluster of Docker hosts that's able to kind of host containerized applications centrally. And there's also the notion of storage, right? So storage is actually one of the big elephants in the room, so to speak, when it comes to containerization. Mm-hmm. Handling persistent storage is actually a huge challenge, and there's a few players in the industry who are really looking to solve those problems, including one called ClusterHQ, who has actually a driver that allows you to plug in clustered storage to a clustered Docker container host environment. So there's some really interesting stuff going on there.
So, okay, I've got a question for you. Now, me being a converted IT pro, now what I mean by that is I used to be an IT pro back in the day, 5 or 4 years ago, whatever, and I used to press buttons like next, 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 you know, the GUI in Windows Server 2008 when you're setting stuff up. This is before PowerShell. PowerShell came around. I didn't take too long. I sort of took to it. I started playing with it pretty early. And now I'm more of a DevOps sort of person, they would say. Sort of, I'm touching Visual Studio, JSON, PowerShell, all that sort of stuff, right? Now, as far as that's concerned with the three levels of there's IT Pro, DevOps, and Developer, who is this suited for? Could I tomorrow like sit down and start playing with containers? Would I know with my knowledge, or do I have to be a developer to go and develop my app into a container?
You don't really have to be a developer. And that's kind of one of the nice things about containers is that they solve multiple problems. I would, based on my experience, and obviously other people may have a different perspective on this, but from my perspective, I think it is definitely a developer-focused tool. And I think that you know, most people are going to try to be packaging applications in, you know, inside Docker containers, which is what it's designed for. Mm-hmm. But it is technically possible to run essentially a virtual machine of sorts. It doesn't have its own kernel, but you know, it's possible to basically isolate an operating system like CentOS or you know, Ubuntu Linux or Alpine Linux if you want a super lightweight distribution. And you can basically play around with it, you know, install packages, treat it like a virtual machine. Okay. And when you're done with it, you can either discard the container or stop the container and save its state so you can restart it later on. But yeah, it is generally more of a developer feature.
Okay, so we're talking about, like I said, the isolation, talking about run Docker containers and that being like virtual machines. So does that sort of mean that we're, as Mark was alluding to, we've got the physical hardware, we've got the virtualization layer, and then effectively, like virtual machines, we've got more containers and those sort of things. So is it that sort of concept?
Yeah, exactly. So I hesitate to call it virtualization as much as isolation. So essentially what the C groups and namespacing functionality in the Linux kernel allows you to achieve is isolation of those CPU and memory resources and disk resources using what's called a copy-on-write file system. There's actually several different file systems that are used by Docker, such as I think there's one called Device Mapper and AUFS. I don't think that stands for Australia, but yeah, I mean, there's where was I going with this? Oh yeah, there's many different levels of isolation. There's network isolation, there's CPU isolation, there's memory isolation, there's storage isolation, and so on.
So basically, what we've got is, I suppose, to summarize it from what I'm hearing, is that virtualization at the first layer gives you the hardware isolation, you know, the isolation from your hardware, your physical disks, all that sort of stuff. Many virtual machines on one physical host. So Docker's sort of the next level above this, giving us that isolation of our CPU, our memory, our storage. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, definitely. And the cool thing here is that what we're going to see with Docker containers is basically better utilization, and when I say better, I specifically mean more efficient utilization of compute resources, right? So when you kind of take these monolithic applications, what you often see is that, you know, you'll still have somewhat of a distributed architecture where you'll have, you know, your database server or cluster, you'll have, you know, web servers, you have middle tier servers, you'll have perhaps a caching layer and to cache, you know, user sessions and things like that. And what ends up happening, right, is on, like, let's say you've got, you know, 5 web front end servers, right? All they do is they sit there and serve web requests all day, and they talk to the middle tier or to the database and to the caching layer to obtain stateful information from the system to then present to the user, right? So the web front ends are as stateless applications. They don't really have a lot of intelligence built into them. Mm-hmm. I mean, sure, that's where your front end code is being served to your users, but I mean, they're so lightweight, and they scale to tens of thousands of users potentially per host, depending on how they're sized, right? So what ends up happening is you know, you've got IT departments that basically over provision hardware, so they've got, you know, 8-core or 16-core systems that are, you know, running 32 or 64 gigs of RAM as their front-end web servers, and they're basically sitting there at, like, what, maybe 2-5% utilization. And what if we could actually take advantage of the rest of the resources that physical hardware or virtual hardware potentially is offering, right?
It's all more bang for your buck. It's all about the public cloud. The more density they have, the more money they're going to make off that hardware.
That's a great word, density.
Yep. Density. So my other question, it's a bit of a curly one. Now, let me take you back. Go back to about 2012. I don't know if you've heard, but there's a guy called Mark Rusinovich who works for Microsoft. He's a CTO of Azure. He brought out a patent. It's on Google. You can Google search it. It's Virtual Machine Preserving Host Updates. Now, basically what it is, in a nutshell, it's a way of patching the operating system,
layers of the operating system while preserving the state of the running virtual machines on top. You've probably heard of that technology and been talked about in the past. Microsoft people in Australia here have mentioned that too. No one's given a sort of official word on it, but I'm guessing that technology is based on containers. Would I be right?
To be entirely honest,
I guess.
I honestly have no idea. I mean, it doesn't surprise me that Mark Rusinovich came up with something like this, but...
Because the more I mention it, people are saying, yeah, Linux have had that sort of type of stuff for a while. And then when you said to me before that containers came out with Linux originally, the light came on my head and put two and two together, thinking, that relates back to what they're trying to do with Windows Server and sort of put it in different layers, like the networking layer and the storage layer and stuff like that. And if they have to do an update to the networking layer, they just reboot that layer itself or the container. And there's a short blip, the virtual machine has experienced no outage, basically.
Yeah, and Hyper-V, I think, has had that since 2008, when Windows Server 2008 R2 came out. It's had, support for hot migrations.
Migration.
I might be wrong on... thank you, live migration. The challenge with doing hot migration or live migrations like that on Hyper-V or really any hypervisor is that you're basically moving the entire operating system from one host to another. And the great thing about kind of a microservice-oriented architecture that's distributed using containers is that these containers are much lighter weight, right? So if you have to move a container for whatever reason, whether it's balancing the capacity across all of your hosts or whatever,
yes.
For some reason you need to get a container from one host to another host, you're talking about megabytes. You're measuring the size of the container in megabytes versus gigabytes. So I think there's a lot of agility that you gain by minimizing the overhead there.
Okay.
All right. So let's talk about the commercialization, obviously, of these products. We all need to make money and survive these days. Is it possible, do you see it going forward, is that, I as a developer write a common container that can then be used by other developers to make calls. So a bit like a function call. I write a common function and then anybody else can then call that.
Yeah, so that's actually a huge component of Docker is what's called the Docker Hub, and then Docker also has, as you probably are alluding to, the commercial trusted registry solution, the DTR, as you'll commonly hear it referred to. And what this allows us to do is to basically build custom container images that have application code embedded inside there. And you can basically seal that up just like an operating system image and then share that on the Docker Hub or through a private internal trusted registry in an enterprise. So the element of sharing these container images is very powerful. In fact, there's vendors that are popping up around this particular space. There's actually an open source solution that VMware created called VMware Harbor, and I actually just recently implemented that as part of one of the projects that I'm working on for a Fortune 500 company within the past 2 weeks. So, that ability to share these to build and share these images, and more importantly, to automate the building of the images through what are called Docker files. You'll see that basically all over the place. You have this Docker file that basically has these instructions that build out your complete image with all your app code inside there, and you seal it up and share it.
Are those Docker codes you're talking about, are they open source? Do you see them being commercialized? I mean, obviously, at the end of the day, we need to make some money doing this. Is the money to be made typically solving the problem using these tools, or is there potentially commercialization in selling the tools or developing a good component or container and reselling it? I mean, what's the sort of feel in the industry? It seems to me, coming from a Linux style background, that the containers are going to be open source and they're going to be used to solve a problem. But again, in this sort of world of, okay, where do people make money and how do you get paid for the amount of effort that you put in to create the container or solve the little microservices problem, where do you feel that sort of fits in?
Yeah, so the commercialization of the container ecosystem is really interesting. In fact, that's one of the questions that I raised to some of the executives of Docker when I was at DockerCon in early June. And, I think Docker is still, so Docker sells the trusted registry. They sell the universal control plane. They also have a new Docker cloud solution that basically allows you to manage Docker hosts running on various platforms using a kind of centralized interface. So it's kind of an abstraction layer for your Docker infrastructure, which is kind of cool. But what's really even more interesting than I think what Docker Core is doing is that there's all these vendors that are popping up in the ecosystem that are solving all sorts of problems with containers, right? So you've got commercial solutions out there for things like ClusterHQ. They're doing container storage clustering. And then you've also got this really interesting vendor I just came across recently called Twistlock. And what they're doing is selling a solution that allows you to basically plug into your existing Active Directory on premises, and that's running in your data center, and you can actually control access to containers, Docker containers, by using this Twistlock solution using role-based access control. So you can actually use your existing users and groups that are inside Active Directory to control access to it. So when IT engineers are looking at, hey, how do I kind of handle that point-and-click configuration of my Docker infrastructure, they're going to want to start looking at some of these vendors in the ecosystem and, figure out how those can help solve some of the, access control and storage challenges that they're experiencing.
Here's an idea. There's just relating back to WordPress for a sec. Everyone knows what WordPress is. I think they run 25% of the internet globally. That's a huge number. But there's a website called Envato Market. Have I pronounced that properly? I think it's basically a theme area where you can go to market of themes, and developers sort of around the world can post their theme up there. And they can put them up for sale, say like for $60 or $59. What I'm just looking one here. And this one here, for example, is $59. It's had 1,600 sales. Now, if you do the math, that's quite a bit of coin. And the company Envato Market, I watched the video on it the other day, how they started. It started off small and it just literally exploded. And now they're making in the millions and millions of dollars. So this is like, I guess, the same thing with Docker that we're talking about with the solutions that Rob was talking about to make some money out of it, is to have some sort of an online community. Now, I guess this is going to tie into my other question I had before, was there's also, we've got to think about the Azure Marketplace. And I think you mentioned before, Trevor, was the Docker Hub, other areas where people can share solutions and other containers.
So Docker is running it's either an alpha or beta or something right now of a new solution that's very similar to actually the Azure Marketplace, where you can, so Azure Marketplace obviously enables you to purchase things like premium virtual machine images and other custom software solutions that run on Microsoft Azure from vendors. The Docker Store is basically going that route for Docker container images. So the Docker Hub right now has no kind of payment model built into it, but the new Docker Store solution is basically going to be this container image marketplace where vendors are able to package up their solution inside a container image and then distribute that or sell that on that marketplace.
So just quickly, with the Azure Marketplace now, because we're all familiar with that, if I was to log into the portal, would I be right in saying that eventually I'll go to the Azure Marketplace and then say browse for all the Docker images available and go and deploy a Docker image direct from the Azure Marketplace?
I have not heard anything about that whatsoever, but that would be pretty cool.
It would make sense.
If there was some integration.
Watch the space.
Rob? Agreed.
Okay, so... we've gone back to the average IT pro, the guy in the field that may be looking at Server 2016. How do I actually go about getting my hands dirty with this sort of stuff? I've never seen Docker before. You may have watched a few videos, but in your mind, what's first steps to actually experiencing this and beginning to understand how to get all this working from a DevOps side rather than just a pure developer? How do I get some feeling about this potential wave of new developments or new configurations that are obviously not far along the horizon for us?
So that's a great question. You know, there's a lot of interesting questions that are coming up in the community, communities that I participate in. For example, the PowerShell Slack channel, which has been really interesting with all the new PowerShell core announcements that have been coming out. And, you know, I actually built a video that's on MSDN channel 9 that talks about how to get PowerShell core running inside a Docker container. And
I'm going to watch it. Definitely. We'll put the link in the show notes.
Cool. Yeah, it's actually on the MSDN homepage right now because, you know, I produced it kind of ahead of the announcement and then got in touch with them and they decided to put that on the front page along with the announcement. So, and that gets a lot of traffic. Some of these videos I've done have like upwards of 40, 50,000 views on them, just mainly from being on the front page, not because they're super interesting. But that's for you to judge. in any case, some really interesting questions that have come up in the community, though, are basically like, you know, what are Windows containers and what are Linux containers? And then people start asking, hey, can I run this CentOS container or like a MySQL running on CentOS container image on Windows Server 2016 container host? And can I run, you know, Microsoft Nano Server images on a Linux container host? And the answer is no. And I think that something that needs to be really clear to anyone who's breaking into containers is that there is a shared management API. So what Microsoft is basically doing with the Windows container platform on Windows Server 2016 is they're making sure that they're API consistent with the Linux container solution, the Docker on Linux, right? But that's basically where the commonalities end, right? So when you actually run a container, you have to know, am I running a Linux container, like the Docker container format, or am I running a Hyper-V container or Windows Server container on Windows?
Right.
So there's basically the Docker container format on Linux, but then on the Windows side of things, there's actually two different container formats, as if things weren't confusing enough already between Windows and Linux. So we have Hyper-V containers, which is basically a lightweight container wrapper around virtual machines. I'm actually still trying to figure out exactly what's the difference between a traditional Hyper-V virtual machine and a Hyper-V container. Honestly, I don't think that there's going to be a whole lot different there. What I am interested in seeing, though, is if there's only certain operating systems that are supported as a guest inside of Hyper-V containers, because I'm suspecting that there may be a limitation, and don't quote me on this, but this is just a suspicion on my part that maybe you'll have to have a Windows Server 2016 or higher running inside that Hyper-V container. I don't know that, though. But what the cool thing on the Windows side is that there's Windows Server containers, though. And those are basically the Docker on Linux equivalent, but on Windows. And the Windows Server containers are basically that application-level isolation rather than hardware-level isolation.
Okay, and so basically these things that Microsoft are talking about at the moment out in the field, like they're going out and spruiking Windows Server 2016 and Windows 10 anniversary update, you have now containers, but this is the Windows containers, not the Docker containers, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
and cool. To kind of confuse the situation, what they actually have you install the Docker daemon on Windows natively, so it's actually a Docker engine that's listening for connections on Windows natively, and that's what controls these Windows containers on the anniversary update. But it's totally different container image formats.
Lucky you, we cleared that up. That's awesome. Okay, now just quickly, we're coming to near the end of this, so we're just going to have to start to wrap this up. But I remember you said to me before, I think we were sort of organizing this a couple of weeks ago, this time was good because it was in time with an announcement. Is that the announcement we talked about before with the open source of PowerShell? Or was there another announcement that you might be able to allude to? No?
No other announcements that I'm aware of.
Yeah, that's okay. All right. Because we've talked about a couple already. Now, Rob, have you got any final questions from your side?
Just a quick one. Obviously, one of the major concerns that we have in today's environment is around security. And it sounds to me, on the outside anyway, from what I've heard, is we've got a lot of these components floating around. We've got open source. We've got a bit of Linux. We've got a bit of Windows. We've got, you know, two or three things on Windows. That obviously is a lot of complexity by the sound of it, and hopefully that's going to simplify as we go down there. But What's the take, or what's your feedback on the security? To me, it sort of sounds, with a lot of moving components and connecting microservices together, that we could be in for a bit of a security challenge when it, you know, goes to assigning rights and making sure the right people have the right access and the microservices are talking to each other in the right way. Can you give us just a bit of an overview or the thinking behind the security when it comes to this containerization?
Sure. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, you know, there are vendors out there that are solving the problems of, you know, access control to containers. You know, right now, Docker is really only 3 years old, and, you know, in cloud years, it's more like 15. But, you know, it is relatively a new thing, and obviously, Microsoft's solution for containers hasn't even hit the market officially yet. So, you know, there's a lot of problems to, or scenarios to solve as we go forward, and there are vendors that are. And confusion, yes. Hopefully, as things develop, things will become more clear over time. But, you know, to most people, I would say kind of like, you know, focus on one area. Don't try to do too much at the same time. If you're just starting out with containers, you know, focus on, you know, Linux containers. They're pretty mature, pretty powerful. But in terms of security, there's vendors solving these problems. You know, one of the biggest security challenges that I think we're currently seeing is that cloud hosts are not really willing to provide multi-tenant architecture or multi-tenant solutions for Docker containers. So, you know, Microsoft Container Service is actually like your own dedicated infrastructure. Same thing with Amazon EC2 Container Service, ECS. You know, all of those solutions are really doing is spinning up your own. They're automating the process of spinning up your own infrastructure to run containers on, typically through Docker Swarm. But at this point in time, I'm not aware of any vendors who are providing kind of a container as a true container as a service platform where they actually sell container capacity, right? And they're actually hosting other customers' containers on the same Docker host that your containers are running on. So I think as we see vendors starting to solve some of these access control problems and other security related things, we're gonna potentially start to see, you know, cloud vendors that do offer a true container as a service offering, which I think is great for them because they can make the most efficient use of their compute resources.
Okay, we better wrap things up. Now, Trevor, if you want to just tell people about it, firstly, thank you for your time, and thanks for clearing up the confusion. Lucky we did this 30 minutes. I guess more of these podcasts that people do around the world and more of events that we go through, and especially yourself, Trevor, all helps with the clearing up of the confusion and help people to understand all about containers and Docker and all that sort of stuff. Now, can you just give people sort of an idea how they can contact you and your blog site or any video site or... that you've got?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks, Mark, for having me on. You can find me online at trevorsullivan.net. You can find my business at artofshell.com. We actually have some streaming training, video-based training through a streaming format, a monthly subscription model that you can access that covers PowerShell, Azure, Docker, and other topics as I have time to produce content aside from consulting projects. You can also find me online at Twitter at PCGeek86 as well as artofshell. Feel free to reach out.
And you're very lucky living in Canada because at least you're in the same time zone as Microsoft. Us here in Australia, we're like all over the place. We hardly sleep.
I'm pretty close. I'm actually an hour ahead of Microsoft, but yeah, I've always wondered, you know, I work with multinational teams on some of these projects I'm working on, and, you know, we're waiting for people in India to wake up and test things out that we're working on. So yeah, it certainly presents a challenge. Yep.
Cool. All right, Trevor. Rob, you got anything else you want to add just briefly?
No, just a quick thing, I suppose, Trevor, for the people out there who are obviously, you know, interested in all this sort of stuff and want to take the next step, let's hope that they, first thing I would suggest by the sound of it is they need to make sure their PowerShell skills are up to speed. If they're a Windows-based IT pro, where will we send them? Where's the one place that we can send them to, you know, learn a bit more about? Is it Channel 9 the best option?
TrevorSullivan.net.
Obviously, I mean, you know, but
I try, unfortunately. I can't cover everything. But yeah, I mean, honestly, the Microsoft documentation, if they're a Microsoft-centric IT yep. pro, I mean, absolutely the Microsoft documentation. Microsoft is moving a lot of their stuff to GitHub, actually, which is really interesting. Mm. You know, you can now edit PowerShell documents. Mm. You can edit Azure documents. I think some other products are going that way, too. So if you're an IT pro and you're not on GitHub, get on GitHub, because that's where a lot of stuff okay. is happening.
Yeah, I suppose that's the other good. Yeah, the other big thing I would agree with you there is that obviously PowerShell, but the GitHub, that sort of mentality to get into the DevOps is certainly a way to go. So I think that's great advice. So I think that's all that I've got for this episode, Mark. Anything else from you?
No, I think that's that comes to the time. We should. That's probably enough for this time. I'm sure we'll probably organize another catch up again at sometime in the future. So thank you for coming on, and thank you everybody for listening.
You have been listening to the Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. For training on using technologies like SharePoint Online or Office 365, visit www.ciaopsacademy.com. By purchasing from the selection available, you'll be directly supporting this podcast. To provide feedback on this episode, visit www.ciaops.com/contact. This podcast is voiced and produced by me, Mark Keane.